Welcome to the Coaching in Clubland podcast. My name is Mitch Johnston and I'll be your host. Coaching in Clubland is an Aussie podcast designed for current and aspiring coaches from all levels and across a range of sports to share their experiences about the caper. We discuss the roller coaster that is the coaching experience, the highs, the lows, the joys and the pitfalls. I caught the coaching bug as a teenager and have been fortunate enough to hold various coaching roles within cricket and footy clubs over the last 15 years. Through these experiences and my interactions as a player, I've come across many great and some not so great coaches in Clubland. We'll aim to keep things simple, practical and relatable so that you can apply these insights to your own coaching experiences. Sit back, grab a cuppa and please enjoy the episode. In this episode of Coaching in Clubland, we speak to John Buchanan. John Buchanan is the most successful international cricket coach in history, with a staggering winning percentage of over 75% across all three formats of the game. While good enough to play seven first-class games and one List A game for Queensland in 1978-79, John shifted his focus to education, work and family time over the ensuing 16 years, before landing the role of Queensland coach before the 1994-95 season. John made an immediate impact, with Queensland claiming their first Sheffield Shield title after 69 years in the competition. Buck would lead the Bulls to another Shield title and two more domestic one-day titles in the 90s before becoming the Australian men's cricket team coach in November of 1999. Along with Steve Waugh and Ricky Ponting as captains, he would lead the team to unparalleled success, including 16 consecutive Test wins, claiming the 2003 and 2007 One-Day World Cups, conquering the final frontier of India in 2004, and the memorable Ashes clean sweep of 2006-07. After finishing with the Aussie team in 2007, John would have roles as Kolkata Knight Riders coach in 2008-2009, as well as consultancy and director of cricket roles with England and New Zealand cricket. Nowadays, John runs Buchanan Success Coaching, who offer leadership and management skills workshops and mentoring, predominantly in the corporate sector. In our chat with John, we talk about having inner strength and confidence as a coach despite not having played at the highest level, setting goals and a vision for your team, and managing difficult personalities, in his case, the one and only SK Warne. This episode is proudly brought to you by Big Dog Clothing. For high-quality sports apparel and lifestyle clothing, visit www.bigdog.com.au to view their range. That's dog with a double G. And for listeners who follow both Big Dog Clothing and our podcast on Facebook, Instagram or Twitter, if you share a post, story or retweet a podcast episode, you'll go into the running for a weekly $30 voucher. Entries close Tuesday 5pm each week. Okay, legends, let's get stuck into the episode. Welcome to the Coaching Clubland podcast, John Buchanan.
Thanks, Mitch. Great to be here.
John, it's amazing to have you on. My childhood coincided with the famous Australian team of the late 90s, early 2000s, which they were under your stewardship. So I'm very excited about the conversation this afternoon. But ahead of a huge summer of cricket with the Ashes looming, where do we find you at the moment and what's your current involvement in cricket?
Right. So I'm in Brisbane, home of the first test match, and hopefully, you know, it'll be a five-day game, although the weather and the pending weather just about to start again over the weekend suggests that the wicket will offer a little bit to the bowlers. So whether it can go 5 days or not is another matter. But, yep, Brisbane's home. And cricket-wise, really not too heavily involved. Was coaching one of the premier grade sides here just pre-COVID, did a couple of seasons with West in premier grade, which was an active involvement. My son Nicholas is still playing, so go out and keep an eye on him. And in fact, tomorrow catching up with Justin Langer. We've sort of stayed in touch probably since he took over or even well before he took over, but certainly since he's taken over. And obviously he's faced a few challenges along the way, more so than many. And yeah, it'll be good to have a bit of yarn to him, a little bit about the Ashes and what's been happening and what's ahead.
Has that criticism of Justin been fair in your eyes there? I mean, obviously the claiming the T20 World Cup in the last few weeks has probably reduced some of that pressure, but is there any argument for splitting coaches across formats, or is that too simplistic a view?
Well, I think criticism is always there. Certainly when I was involved as coach, and when you look at whether it be football or netball, you mentioned before we came on air, and cricket, any sport where you're a head coach and elite sport, there are always knives poised to be plunged when the opportunity presents itself. If you're winning, it certainly is a bit of a shield against those sorts of criticisms. And generally those criticisms are pretty superficial. they really don't understand the role of a coach. They don't understand the dynamics of a team. They don't really step inside a team culture to find out more about maybe some claims that some individuals might have at some time. So my overall view is criticism generally is pretty well ill-founded, but nonetheless, it's there and you need to deal with it. So from Justin's point of view, you know, he's been spending time obviously trying to deal with some of the player criticisms, or at least some of the alleged player criticisms, and some of those that have found their way into the media. And he is the right person. I mean, he was the right person chosen at the time. The team was in quite a bit of disarray, really, from what had happened previously. And he was given the task of really pulling that group together, because he is a very principled person. He is a very value-driven person, a very hard-working person, a very authentic person, and certainly wears his heart on his sleeve. He's a passionate Australian. And so he was the right person positioned for the team, and I think still is. I still think there are certainly remnants of some of the probably behaviours, maybe, probably some of the values that needed a bit more fine-tuning are still sort of lingering. And that's not just within the team. I think it probably sits outside the team a little bit too. So he's certainly the right person. And having, as you said, just won the T20 World Cup, that means that those criticisms or those knives have been thwarted for the time being. And I just think come the end of the Ashes, Australia will come out on top. And so that should give him the opportunity and the breathing space that he needs to go about doing the job that he was empowered to do and needs to be let do.
Those knives have been kept at bay for now, and with Justin's recent success. But in terms of success, you were the most successful international cricket coach in history in terms of winning percentage and also the ICC tournaments that you were able to claim as well. But can you define what success looks like for you as a coach? Is it merely winning, or can success as a coach be defined in other ways as well?
Well, there's no doubt that whether you're a coach or a business leader, politician, you still got to get results. That's why you're there. I mean, sport's about winning and losing. It's nothing in between that, certainly at an elite level anyway. And so if you're not getting results, then really you don't get the opportunity to stay around too much longer to develop systems and processes. But for me, it was always about process, trying to get our processes right, trying to get our systems as good as they could be, trying to have them at leading edge or at least world's best practice, so that if we put all that around a group of very talented individuals, then hopefully the results would follow from that. So, yeah, results are really important. But I guess for me, success was always, again, defined by getting those processes, systems right. And one of those in particular was really just, you know, the relationships that you had with your players. That's the key to coaching. That's the key to success, I think. And certainly in most cases, that's how I would judge my success, by how well I was able to establish, maintain, and still have, you know, those personal relationships.
And prior to turning your hand to coaching, you played 7 first-class games and 1 List A game for Queensland in 1978-79 before, again, focusing on the coaching side of things. So for someone who didn't don the baggy green and had the chance to work with the likes of Ponting, Warren McGrath and the War Brothers, to name just a few, how did you go about developing the confidence in your own coaching abilities and philosophies to make an impact on the Australian cricket team? And by extension, was there any self-doubt because you hadn't played international cricket?
Well, I think all coaches, no matter who they are and what their experiences have been, there will always be self-doubt at different times. But look, my journey was probably a little bit different to most, or at least at that time, and maybe even these days, you know. So as you said, I had a pretty meagre run at first-class cricket. And, you know, that was 16 years before I became a head coach of the Queensland side. So I did a lot of things in between time. And that was always pursuing, you know, various dreams that I might have about where my life, where my career, and therefore for my family, was going to take me. And so that took me on various treks through sports administration, through teaching, through lecturing, through a couple little ventures, then into government. And in all those places, I was always seeing myself as, yeah, rising to the top somewhere and you know, running a team and running an organisation, running a business, whatever it might be. And I kept my relationship with cricket, albeit a little bit tenuous, but it became a little bit stronger once our family, you know, arrived and the boys and the girls started to become involved in junior sport. And so that took me back into junior cricket. It took me back into doing this thing called coaching, trying to organise young players and parents and everybody else to try to ensure that if they're there for 2 hours for a Saturday morning session, everybody was going to walk away happy and wanting to come back next week, you know. So I did that. And then once we came back to Brisbane, I rejoined my old career club, which was University Career Club, and went back to coach them for 2 years. And we were able to win a club premiership and a title in the one-day arena as well, which the club hadn't done since I was playing there. So that was encouraging, but other family came along. So it was time to be a dad and make sure that I was around, not only to look after children, but also to give my wife a bit of a break. And along the line came the Queensland job. And I spoke to Ian Healy and about it and said, well, you know, was Queensland Cricket really serious about replacing Geoff Thompson? And he said they were, if they could find the right coach. And I said, well, that's great. But hypothetically, you know, my background, and I had known Ian for some time. I had coached him when he was younger. You know, my background, it doesn't stack up cricket-wise, but I think I can do the job. And he said, yeah, well, if you were given the opportunity, we'll certainly give you a run at being coach, but obviously you've got to prove that you can. So that's what really set me out on understanding me as a coach. So, you know, I used to run a lot in those days, and so I'd head out and think through why I did what I did, why I said what I said, why I had the ideas that I had. And so that really began to shape my coaching philosophy, my values, my principles, et cetera. And so when the interview came around, I was then able to present to Queensland Cricket not the pedigree of a cricket player, but what I thought was the pedigree of a cricket coach, and convinced those who were interviewing me that I should get the job. And I took over from Geoff Thompson. And it was in that first year that I was coaching that we won the Sheffield Shield for the first time. Now, you know, that was an exciting time for everybody involved in Queensland cricket. And it's not to say for one moment that just my appointment was the key difference, because Queensland had come so close so many times, and factors beyond their control had somehow organised themselves to keep Queensland away from that holy grail. But one of the keys, I guess, for me was when you go back to what does success look like. So I painted them a picture that success for me wasn't about winning the Sheffield Shield, albeit that I knew that's what we all wanted. But really, the picture was we were going to dominate domestic cricket for the next 10 years. And then if we can get the system and processes in shape, then we would win a shield, and not only would one, but we'd be able to continue winning. So that was the kind of the concept that I put forward, and they heard and listened and gave me the opportunity.
You touched on your life experience and education background, and I think that's such an important thing for a coach to be able to lean on some of those experiences rather than just being in the cricket bubble or whatever sport it might be, to actually have some life experience to draw on when it comes to sacking someone or having that really difficult conversation. I think that's a really important skill set to have. And
it's not just it's just not the sacking someone or the difficult conversation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's the challenging conversations. You know, you're able to come into the cricket mix or into the dressing room, if you like, and try as much as you can to take people outside the dressing room. And that's difficult for some, obviously, because that's where they're most confident. That's what they know. Mm-hmm. That's how they've grown up, and that's where they want to be. But unfortunately, if that's where they remain, then as we know, as a cricketer or as a career coach, that part of your life comes to an end. There is no way that it continues. And so you need to be able to make sure that you're prepared and preparing yourself to transition from a cricket life, whatever that looks like, into the next life. And so for me, that's what I thought I could bring into the group, that it was about, yes, I love cricket and I wanted to coach cricket, but it was also about trying to think beyond cricket, beyond those boundaries, and take people outside their comfort zones.
And that Queensland group that you picked up in 1994, 95, and as you said, breaking that 69-year drought, you had a nucleus of, you know, Border, Rackerman, Barsby, Stuart Law, and then talent coming through with Matty Hayden, who was already setting the world on fire, and Martin Love and Andy Bickle. So you had the group there. What were some of your immediate priorities in galvanising this group and getting them from bridesmaids or being close to claiming a shield to actually getting over the line?
Well, it was very much that sort of vision. It was about trying to always exercise the ghosts of the past, because I remember facing that. I remember people talking about that. The media and everybody would always talk about that. You know, is this going to be the year again? And you know, Queensland would go reasonably well, and Christmas would come around, and then generally in those days or beforehand, then Queensland would go on a southern tour and start losing games, and suddenly they'd move from, you know, top of the Shield table, challenging for a place in the final, to somewhere back in the pack. So then the words would go around, oh, here we go again. So there was that constant sort of record that played almost every year. So for me, it was about trying to understand process of winning and not so much about the winning, although that's what we obviously wanted to do. Mm. And then it was about bringing the old together with the young. So in other words, we had a couple of squads going on. We had our senior squad, and within that senior squad, obviously the guys that were playing for Australia, yep, who would come in and out every so often. And then we had our academy squad, our younger players, and you mentioned some of them, the likes of Hayden but Love and Ma, Mott and Simons, a number of those younger guys who were, you know, just loving their cricket. So it was about merging the two groups, if you like, together so that they could both learn from each other and certainly challenge each other. So the young would always be challenging the older guys, but the older guys would have experience and knowledge that they could then share and impart to the younger ones. And, you know, I just remember in those days, the old dressing rooms of Queensland cricket, we had a dog track around the outside of the ground, and you'd walk over the dog track and into the dressing rooms, and Alan Border would have his corner there, and he loved talking cricket. And and so after a training session over a beer or two, not with everybody with their feet in the ice bucket and, you know, some on the massage table, it was just everybody was in the dressing room, and he'd sit around and the young guys would be there just talking about cricket, you know, and really enjoying his stories and the way that he went about what he did. And that's what he really enjoyed as well. So it was, again, a bit of a system and a bit of a process, but it was really owned by the group in a way that we were able to really harness all the talents and all the experiences and the youthful exuberancy of the whole group, you know. So that really made a big contribution to why that team, I think, came together really quite well and did so over a long period of time.
It came together very well to the tune of, you know, two Sheffield Shields. You had a brief foray with Middlesex as well in 98 before picking up the Australian job in November of 99. And the team had just beaten Zimbabwe in a one-off test, and then we're about to go on a run of 15 or 16 consecutive test victories, so it's not a bad way to start. Alongside captain Steve Waugh, you set highly ambitious goals for the Australian team and often referenced the concept of conquering Everest. So when it comes to establishing goals and a vision for a team, what are some advice that you have for coaches?
Yes, look, I think as a coach, no matter who you're operating with, you're always influencing people. And again, for me, as I said, one of the important steps for me as a coach was to understand me first and foremost. So that's just so critical. And part of my philosophy is definitely about a vision. It's always about trying to test the boundaries. It's always in a cricket sense, and that's where the Everest notion came from. You want to be at the top, but to be at the top, it was about trying to change the game, trying to be ahead of the pack, trying to anticipate maybe where the game was going or should be going, and you're going to be the leader of the pack. So for me, that's a really important step for a coach to have. And then, of course, it's all very well for you to have it, but it's so important then that the rest of the group begin to understand it or own it as well. So the next most important part for the coach is to make sure that you and the captain are aligned. You may not say the same things or in the same way, but you need to be aligned in terms of where you're going. And I know with Stephen, that was always the case, because his mantra was about taking the road less travelled. You know, when we would be touring, he was very much a person about, again, experiencing what's around, not just staying in your hotel room or staying at the ground, but trying to take in what's around. And that was, again, aligned with how I viewed my role within the group. So they're two really important things. And then the third is obviously key people within the group. Who are your key disciples, if you like? There will always be the knockers. There will always be those that resist. But there are also those who want to change. They want to go somewhere. They want to do some things differently. And so who are those people within your group? And some will have a formal role, you know, some might be a captain, vice captain, and support people, you know. So in a lead team, it might also be a physio, it might be a team manager, you know, other people around. So it's about really identifying who are those disciples and making sure that they're always informed as well. So that for those who doubt or for those who are unsure, then the messages are coming from a whole range of different ways to ensure that, yeah, gradually everybody jumps on the same bus, going in the same direction, as maybe Stephen Covey might say.
And in terms of disciples, obviously Stephen Waugh himself, we've spoken about Justin Langer already, Matty Hayden and Andrew Simons, among another few there who had spent time with you at Queensland, but perhaps Shane Warne and wasn't as aligned with his thinking. And speaking to Paddy Upton a few months ago, he, you know, obviously as a franchise coach, there's very much, if they're not buying in, you can sort of flick them, but you can't, it's very hard to flick someone with 708 test wickets there. So what advice do you have for coaches in terms of managing personalities that might be difficult at times and not always aligned to your philosophy?
Yes, well, I think a couple of things. Firstly, as it still keeps coming back to the same central point, you've got to understand you've got to believe in yourself and you've got to back yourself. So that means that, yeah, there are going to be difficult times with either a difficult player or a difficult situation or a difficult group of players. So in those times, you've got to definitely not compromise yourself, but you've got to find a way to communicate your messages in a way that hopefully they might hear or at the very least not resist. Now, if they do, then that will lead to some of those tough conversations and that will lead to you being very determined to stick by what it is that you believe is important for either that individual or the group or that situation at that time. So very important to stick to your guns, basically, and find ways of doing that. You know, sometimes if it was a Shane Warne, sometimes the best way to deal with it was not for me to deal with it, you know, so because immediately Shane might put up the shutters, you know, or be critical, or if it was in a group situation, you know, want to place it in an ego battle, which there was no winners either way. So, So therefore, you need to find other ways and means of reaching that person, and that might be through an assistant coach. It might be through one or two of the other players. It might be through a friend of his. It might be through family. You know, so you're always exploring ways and means of reaching some of those individuals. Over time, though, what we're able to establish in that team was really self-regulation, if you like, so that Shane Warne was, when I first started, was, you know, a significant influence in the group because we really only had four, maybe five players, which was the Warne brothers, Warne himself, McGrath, and maybe Slater, who were constants in the side. Hayden hadn't established himself. Langer hadn't established himself. Ponting hadn't established himself. Gilchrist was just started the same test match as I did in the test arena. And so on it went. So he was a significant influence at that time. But gradually over time, those players that I mentioned, plus others, we really built a real solid core in that playing group because it mostly played test and one-day cricket. There were some players like a Michael Bevan who might come in and out because of the one-day arena, but generally we were able to establish a very, very solid core and they began to manage the playing group. Now, whether it was a Warne or a McGill or, you know, a Simons or Hayden, whoever it might have been, that might have, to some degree, kind of stepped out of that indefinable team culture.
Yep.
Then the group would quickly bring them back into line. And so that's the most powerful thing that I think you can do to manage not just the so-called Warns of the world, but to manage everybody in that group. That's a mature group. And ultimately, that's what you're really trying to develop.
No, that's utopia, isn't it, where teams can manage themselves and regulate themselves and you're facilitating. And you're renowned for your innovation and use of vision, data and opposition analysis. So one thing that I've been guilty of, particularly early in my coaching career, was information overload. So how can a coach gauge when they are bordering on the edge of information overload? And have you sort of stripped things back over time with regards to your coaching approach?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think certainly, you know, we were the first to bring in computer technology and then bring in data to, you know, the old team meetings where you'd after training, he'd go into the room and have a couple of beers and everybody'd have a bit of a chat, and the loudest in the room would get most of the floor. And, you know, you'd record a couple of innings here and there, and suddenly that was the team meeting all over and done with and all your planning. And that's, it's a shame that that's gone to some degree, because that really is just a great session for everybody to be involved in. But what I always felt was that there were too many gaps there for us to be well planned, better planned than our opposition. And so that's why computers and data became part and parcel of that meeting, because it just meant our analysis of games and trends that were going on became far more precise. So the knowledge and the experience and the intuition that was being expressed by players could now be supported by data. There was actual evidence there for what they were saying, and therefore that made it more impactful. The other side to it was that it was good for feedback. It just made your feedback a little bit more immediate and certainly far more accurate. So I would certainly push all that out. But many times, I mentioned Border before in the dressing rooms, you know, he pushed back very early, you know, in our first year together, simply because, you know, there was a guy that played 20 years of international cricket or whatever it was, certainly first-class cricket, and he knew his game inside out. So what was a piece of paper with numbers on it going to do for him except complicate the way that he went about his preparation, getting himself into a game and then playing a game? So, you know, you learnt on individual basis and you learnt through group sessions what you could use, how you would use it, how you would deliver it all the time. And I guess I was certainly one like yourself, would be information overload, and I would continue to do that till I could sense or I was told directly, you know, that there's too much going on here. I remember Darren Lehman telling me that through our one-day team at one stage, you know, because I'd do a game sheet for each player, which gave, you know, a whole lot of data about their performance, but also the team performance, and then about what it was that either they could improve or we were going to improve. And that was good for a while. But in the end, basically the players are players, you know, just what's my score, how many wickets did I take, et cetera. Leave the rest to training. And so that's, you know, it's always a fine balance. And I think that's the important thing about coaching. And I mentioned relationships before. I mean, that's where you really need to have a good gauge on where players are at, the group's at, and what you can possibly do, say, how you present it, or, you know, find a way to disguise it.
Yeah, it definitely depends on the group you've got. I mean, if it's an emerging group that needs that extra bit of guidance or feedback, then certainly you need to be a little more hands-on with the information you're giving. Whereas, again, we touched on the groups that can regulate themselves. Perhaps they can really own those conversations too. And one really good example of planning was the Australian tours of the subcontinent in 2004, where after the heartbreak of India in 2001, I guess the final frontier was India, and you happened to win there in 2004, and also a really underrated series victory in Sri Lanka as well, winning 3-0 there. So how much planning did these tours take, considering that the team's brand of play was quite different from what was on Australian soil in terms of, you know, defensive fields and very straight fields? What was some of the work that was done behind the scenes there?
Yes, look, there was a lot of learning came out of 2001. Obviously, we were on that 16 tests in a row, and your strength is your weakness, you know. So we continued to play the way that we'd won games, and it seemed to work in the first test match, but I think, you know, that first test match of that particular series masked our inability to play the likes of Harbhajan in that particular series. And through that, because that was my first tour of India, and through that I got to watch, obviously, but I got to meet a whole lot of different Indians and spoke to the Baitis and the Prasanas and the Venkats, guys that were around and were quite happy to share their knowledge of India and conditions and spin bowling and so on. And so that really then cemented in my mind how we would go about coming back in 2004. And so, you know, we had a very, very clear plan of how we were going to really nullify the Indians' capabilities of scoring boundaries. And we knew if we could do that, then we were in with a real chance of taking wickets and really building up some momentum, because the Indian crowds just love their players and the ball running to the boundary. So we were able to do that. Obviously, Ricky Ponting was injured prior to that, and Adam Gilchrist took over there, and he just did a fantastic job of sticking to the plan and really just delivered on that so well. Obviously, our batsmen still had to score runs, and they were in far better position to do so. Michael Clarke debuting and making 150 in that test match in Bangalore was a great way to start the tour as well. And then same sort of thing in Sri Lanka. You know, it was a case that we hadn't played there for a long time. We hadn't played Murali in Sri Lanka for a long time. So again, it was a case of, well, let's grab some data, let's grab some vision, but let's just grab the top order batsman here. And we'll just spend a whole session for each one of them talking to each other and working out how they would go about playing their game against Murali, plus other Sri Lankan bowlers. And that's where, one, the planning comes into to play. But then, like Gilly and our players in India, it takes courage to do that. And in that first test against Sri Lanka at Gore, you know, we were bowled out pretty cheaply. Murali, I think, took 5 or 6 wickets for, you know, we might have been out for 230. But in that group, there was still a really strong belief that, you know, things weren't going to go the way that they had previously. So the bowlers kept us in the game. I think we got them out for 340, 350 or something. So we're 100 odd behind. But then the batsmen went back out and put together the game plan that they hadn't been able to execute in the first innings. And, you know, I think Hayden made 80 or 90, Martin made 100, Lehman made 100, Kadich might have made 60 or 70, I can't remember. So, but what they did was they just put their game together the way that they had planned to do in the first place. So that's what they did through the whole series. So there is the planning, but obviously then there's the execution, and that really does mean players have got to back themselves, coaches have got to back themselves to do what they said they were going to do.
And that belief you spoke about, I think, and I might be mistaken here, but I think the team conceded a first innings lead in each test in Sri Lanka in that series and had the belief to, you know, to get over the line still. So it's, again, a pretty underrated series victory, I reckon. But moving to the current times, I guess you're the director and owner of Buchanan Success Coaching. Can you talk us through some of the work that you do and, I guess, the overlap between the sporting and corporate world?
Yeah, sure, Mitch. So Buchanan Success Coaching is a coaching and leadership consulting business, and it works with CEOs or senior leadership teams, mainly corporates, ASX, government officials, etc. But in essence, it is taking all the lessons that I've learned in sport as a coach and then converting that into what's relevant to those leaders as they seek either peak performance for their teams or seek to develop a team culture or need some one-on-one executive coaching about them leading or about them dealing with the sort of issues that you've just raised. And the beauty about sport is that it really is a microcosm, if you like, of what happens on just a regular daily basis in the corporate world or in the business world or life outside of sport. Sport has this luxury of preparation time, and then you go and play your game. So as you said, you've got your games on the weekend, and your preparation is to go and have a massage after we finish speaking here to get yourself physically ready for what's
every
ahead
week,
of you.
John.
Every week. But in business, you know, they're in competition every day. So they don't, in the main, they don't spend enough time to either understand what success looks like, as we were talking about before, set themselves up for success on a daily basis, or at least review that. And that's all that sport does. You know, it prepares itself, it goes and plays, then it reviews, and then it sets up again. And really, that's what business needs. That's what leaders need to do far more regularly. That's what the system and processes that they can have need to do. That's what the data needs to help them do. But unfortunately, most businesses don't do that because they just roll around, you know, like, bang, let's get through the day. Ooh, made that. Let's have to wake up, go again. Where do we pick up from? And off they go. So that reflection, that review, that understanding of peak performance, that understanding of Everest, because it relates to, no matter what the team is, all those things relate to every possible team within any organization, and as well the larger organization, because we're all just wheels within wheels, you know. So that's what I do with the consulting business, with mainly corporates. I do a little bit of mentoring, sports mentoring, but not so much these days.
Okay. A lot of those concepts are very transferable, as you just mentioned. And I guess in closing, we've got the Ashes 5 days away. There's been scandals galore with both countries from the racism side of things, and with Azim Rafiq in England and Tim Payne's indiscretions. So, yes, we have an Ashes to play, believe it or not. Can you give us a series prediction? There's a lot of rain around. Does that bring England's seamers, the Ollie Robinsons and Andersons, into play a little bit more than we might have anticipated?
Well, it can do. The thing about the Gabba is, no matter how green the wicket is and how spicy it is, you've actually got to learn how to bowl on it. So while it might be difficult for batting, generally where teams make errors is that their bowlers don't actually get the right lengths. So in other words, they might beat the bat, but they beat the bat by so much that it doesn't matter anyway. So generally at the Gabba, if it's seemingly to be what is likely with all the weather about, then the bowlers have just got to bowl fuller, much fuller lengths. And captains have got to understand that. You know, they've got to therefore be accepting of the fact that sometimes they're going to get driven, you know, for four, because the ball's just going to be a little bit overpitched. But so it's again like any, and then you kind of move from this Gabba, which is a bit of a fortress for Australia. It has been since, I don't know, in 1988 or something. I can't remember now, but it's been a long time since Australia's been beaten at the Gabba. And then you move to this new form of the five-day game, the pink ball game, you know, because I do think it's a different form because, again, while we have weather around the Gabba here, things are still uncertain from day to day to day. But when you get to Adelaide, there is a certainty that you're going to play at night, you know, and that conditions are going to change at night. So there is an absolute predictability to some degree about why you might bat or why you might declare at a certain stage through the game. So anyway, I think pink ball, again, depending on what happens down there, it does mean that the English bowling attack is possibly the key to the series, because with Anderson, Broad, the guys you mentioned, Robertson, Wood, Stokes to some degree as well.
Yeah.
They have the capacity to swing the ball when they need to. They have the capacity to bounce the ball when they need to. They have the capacity to have some pace when they need to, and they have the capacity to seam the ball when they need to. And then Leach can play just a real stock role for them, just to relieve the bowlers, keep the screws on, and keep the pressure on Australia. Now, Australia's batting lineup is still probably pretty fragile. You know, it hasn't played any test cricket for a long period of time. You know, its ability to withstand long sessions of red ball cricket isn't proven at the moment. It hasn't been proven for a while. England's played, a dozen or so test matches through the course of the year so far. So in a sense, they come into the event or into the Ashes a little bit better prepared in terms of actually having played this type of cricket, but it's a home series. Teams struggle to win away from home, have done for a long period of time, and increasingly so. England have found it very difficult here in Australia to win. I'm expecting the same to be the case, and I'm expecting Australia to get up in the series. But score lines, no idea.
Not a Glenn McGrath 5-0.
5-0 or a Shane Warne 5-0. No, let that to them always.
Right. And I think English batting will come under the microscope too with Burns, Hameed, Milan against our pace attack too. So it's going to be interesting to watch, and we look forward to actually getting some cricket underway. John, you've got a conference call coming up. I've got a massage coming up. It's been amazing having a chat to you. Again, having watched the team you coached achieve remarkable success, really, with test victories, World Cups, Champions Trophies, you name it. You've got a real legacy in Australian cricket and Queensland cricket, doing some great work in the corporate space and mentoring coaches too. So thank you so much for giving your time up today.
Thanks for having me on your podcast, Mitch, and all the very best for tomorrow's game. No doubt you'll be churning out the runs or taking the wickets, especially after your massage. So thanks again.
Thanks so much, John. Take care. Thanks for listening to this episode of Coaching in Clubland. A shout out to the talented Aidan Arandes for putting together our podcast theme song. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to hear more, subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcast. Feel free to leave a rating and review. To catch the latest updates from the podcast, check us out on Facebook or on Twitter at Coaching Club Pod. Thanks again, and catch you around in Clubland.